Hello and welcome to Ohio Folklore. I'm your host, Melissa Davies. Today, we're exploring an age-old murder case that has gone unsolved since it happened on April 12, 1901. It's a story that gripped the imaginations of locals back then. And still today, we ponder just how a reclusive, wealthy, 60-year-old woman was bludgeoned to death in her own home. Her 74-year-old husband was found at the scene. With her body not yet cold, the town doctor burst in the door to find this man, his clothing soaked in blood. "If I killed her, I must have done it in my sleep," was the odd non-denial he stammered at the doctor's first questions. Unanswered questions remain, along with the supposed spirit who haunts the turn-of-the-century home where the murder occurred. It stands yet today. I'm talking about the unsolved murder of Rebecca McClung in Mason, Ohio. Today, Mason is a small city of about 35,000 people, situated about 20 miles north of downtown Cincinnati. Most Ohioans know it as the location of Kings Island, that summer destination for thrill seekers. Most amusement park guests hop off I-71 without giving a thought to making the short trek into Mason's quaint downtown. Those few who do find indie coffee shops, craft breweries, and boutiques. Although first plotted in 1803, the community didn't fully blossom into a city until about 25 years ago. This means that the structures which make up the original downtown area are mostly historic, as recent growth has expanded out from the center. One such historic structure at 101 East Main Street stands out among the rest. This Italianate-style brick two-story building was first built in 1879. Considered a mansion in its time, with ornate trim around the windows and porch rails, it was known all too well to the few hundred Masonites who lived there at the time. It was a structure that called attention to itself due to its sheer size, but that's not all that accounted for the strange feelings locals had for the place. The owners, John and Rebecca McClung, were an enigma to many. They never had visitors. The house was always kept shuttered and dark. Anyone approaching the house on business would knock, only to see John open the door and step forward, closing the door behind him. No one was allowed in. Rumors spread about the reclusive, childless couple. It seemed they hadn't left the home for more than 20 years. Was there some illegal operation going on behind closed doors? Was the home unkempt? Did they practice some kind of witchcraft or other perversion that left them hiding within a prison of their own making? Everyone had a different theory on just what the wealthiest couple in town was up to. And what's so remarkable is that Masonites of today still gossip about this very building. Although the McClungs have been gone now for over 100 years, locals of all ages and backgrounds ponder on the mysterious goings-on at this spot of a murder whose case grew cold decades ago. Encounters with spirits at this fabled location are so numerous that members of the Mason Historical Society are no longer surprised to receive new reports of them. Common occurrences include objects being knocked off shelves or thrown across the room, and disembodied sounds and voices. Rebecca McClung's full-bodied apparition is known to present itself to those working in the place. The building has housed many businesses over the decades. Some have spotted her at the top of the stairs, wearing a long dress with a black skirt. Yet perhaps the most dramatic and well-known claim is the appearance of her self-illuminated figure staring out the window of the upstairs room, where she was struck in the head until dead. Children are known to dare one another to look for her as they pass on by the haunting structure. So now that we've learned a little about the common lore associated with this story, let's explore what the historical record has to teach us. Let's imagine ourselves one of the 600 or so Masonites who lived in town at the time of the murder itself. No doubt, word of it spread quickly. For a couple that had been the subject of gossip for so long, folks who'd guessed at the juiciest of reasons for their self-isolation must have felt vindicated. Can't you just hear them saying, "See, I told you they were worshiping the devil in there"? Official word came, as it most often did in those days, in a newspaper. The first headline on the story proclaimed, "Mrs. McClung killed with a heavy club." Her first name wasn't needed. Although few had ever met Rebecca, most everyone knew of she and her husband's peculiar seclusion. It was an early Friday morning that April when John rose at 4 a.m. to feed the livestock in the barn. On finishing, he returned to the house to go upstairs and wake Rebecca, as was their routine each morning. Only this day, he claimed to have found her lifeless body in bed. Her head was caved in and oozed blood, soaking the mattress beneath her. John ran to his neighbors asking for help. They would later testify that his own clothes had been soaked in blood, a detail which would remain scandalous in the trial ahead. The town's physician, a Dr. Van Dyke, was soon summoned to the home. On inspection of the body, he found two deep gashes, one above each eye, and a jagged skull fracture which exposed brain matter. The only intact part of her head was the jaw, leaving her face fully caved inward by the use of some blunt instrument. Naturally, the doctor asked John what had happened, to which he only responded that he had no idea. He claimed to have found her that way on returning from the morning chores. Sensing something wasn't adding up, Dr. Van Dyke soon summoned Coroner Jeffrey Carey of Lebanon. He arrived at the home within a couple of hours. One of the first steps was to rule out a home invasion or robbery. It was well known that John did not trust banks and that he stored large sums of cash in hiding places around the home. However, John denied that anything was missing from the home. Nothing was even out of place or disturbed. John's demeanor was calm and businesslike as he went on answering the coroner's questions. As to the blood which was soaking his vest, coat, and trousers, he said his hands had been sore and cracked the last couple of days, and that he was prone to absent-mindedly wiping them on his clothes. Although the murder weapon was nowhere to be found, a blood-covered piece of bark was discovered on the floor in the room where she'd been killed. From this, Coroner Carey deduced that a heavy piece of firewood had served as the instrument of death. Untouched pieces of wood lay next to the McClung stove, which was burning during the coroner's investigation. It's believed the very murder weapon may have burned to ashes inside that same stove during the early hours of the investigation. About a week later, another headline proclaimed that John McClung had been bound over to the grand jury. Coroner Carey's thorough investigation would conclude that John was the most likely suspect. Rebecca had been bludgeoned to death, likely with a heavy piece of wood, which was never found. It was also alleged that she had long suffered some, quote, mental aberration, which may have proven too much for John to manage in the end. The coroner would issue a charge of murder and place a warrant out for his arrest. John would be taken into custody at the home where he'd isolated himself for so long. He would await trial in custody. Rebecca McClung, once Rebecca Dawson, had lived all her 60 years in Mason. Newspaper articles recounted her odd reputation among the locals, including some accounts that she was known to stare out open second-story windows to eavesdrop on people roaming Main Street below. Although few ever got a close-up view of her, it was said that she knew every person's name and face in town. John had already been declared guilty in the court of public opinion. All that remained was to determine the motive, and the newspaper was happy to offer all the speculation it could gather. The first theory was that a miserly John was afraid he might die before his wife, meaning that his estate, including a 950-acre farm, and cash assets of more than $100,000, would go to his three brothers-in-law. It was rumored that bad blood existed between John and them, since he'd married their sister. The second most common theory was that Rebecca's murder was the culmination of a long-standing argument that had been raging between the couple for some time. The couple had been talking about building a new house. Rebecca wanted an even bigger and more opulent home, which agitated her stingy husband. Although he'd relented to her wishes, he secretly resented how frivolous she'd become. The day before she'd been killed, John signed a contract with a carpenter set to build Mason's next mansion, a monstrosity boasting 14 rooms, which would become the largest home in town by far. It's believed John regretted caving into her demands and fell into a blind rage. John McClung's murder trial was scandalous, drawing so many onlookers that the venue had to be switched from the courthouse to the Opera House, the largest venue around. It was still filled to the brim from the start of the proceedings. The first witness called was so traumatized by the event that she fainted multiple times during testimony, causing the whole proceedings to be drawn out over a period of days. She was a woman named Mrs. Sally Basor. This 43-year-old widow had purchased the home from the McClungs only about a year prior to the murder. With the financial help of her deceased husband's best friend, Albert Dill, this unwed couple rented the upstairs to the McClungs. This unorthodox living arrangement only added more tantalizing details for the town's gossips. It's assumed the sale of the home was necessary to help the McClungs finance the construction of their new mansion, which was set to break ground soon. Sally and Albert continued living on the downstairs floor, while the McClungs occupied the second story. Sally had begun work as a dressmaker and ran her business there at the home. For the first time, two locals would not only be permitted into the normally off-limits home, they would be living in it, day in and day out. Sally would later explain that the McClungs often fought bitterly, and usually over matters of money. Their volatile relationship is what's believed caused their estrangement from the rest of their families, and indeed the whole community. Not only that, but for all the McClungs' wealth, their living space was in constant disarray. Clutter and filth filled the rooms where they stayed. The rumor went that John was such the miser that he and his wife ate mainly the least savory pieces of meat from the livestock they raised. All the best cuts went to market to ensure the best price and profit margin. The unwed Sally and Albert were always within earshot of their arguments, many of which grew to a hateful intensity. In less than a year, the arguments would cease abruptly one spring morning. Sally had heard the whole ordeal. She recalled waking at 4:25 a.m., to the sound of someone moving bits of firewood around upstairs. It was the sound she'd heard countless times, the motion one went through to get a fire roaring for the day. About 15 minutes later came the terrified screams of a woman upstairs, followed by her gargled moans, and then silence. She tried to convince Albert to go investigate, but he dismissed her. Sally went so far as to stop two men walking past their home, asking them to do the same, but none were interested in getting involved with the peculiar couple. 10 minutes later, John himself came downstairs, covered in blood, saying nothing. When Sally asked about Rebecca, he replied, "My God, she is dead," followed a moment later by, "If I did it, I must have done it in my sleep." Albert Dill, for his part, would testify that he had seen John coming out of the barn at about 5:10 a.m., as was his custom every morning after finishing the chores there. Later in the day, after all the excitement had died down, Albert went into the barn to find all the chores had been completed, a task which normally took an hour or more. The defense's theory, based on Albert's testimony, was that John couldn't have possibly done the deed, as the barn chores were his alibi. In a dramatic moment for the prosecution, a local physician displayed bits of Rebecca's brain matter for the jury. He provided expert testimony as to the nature of her injuries and the likely method of the attack. This demonstration included the bloody pieces of bark which were found on the floor of her bedroom. The elderly John McClung sat through the entire proceedings, silent, next to his attorney. Judge John A. Runyon of Lebanon would come to defend John's case and proclaim to the press that not only was John innocent, but that he would be easily cleared of all suspicion. During the proceedings, onlookers noted John's deep interest in all that was being discussed, but a lack of any emotional reaction. Just as the trial was underway, Rebecca's funeral was held simultaneously on April 15th at 10 a.m. at the local Universalist Church. The Reverend Frank Blackford of Eaton officiated. People thronged to the ceremony, including none other than John McClung, accompanied by his sister. Both remained cool and composed throughout the ritual. Coroner Carey, for his part, remained vocal about his assertion that John had been the one to do it. When initial plans were set for the funeral to happen at the house itself, he'd been the one to put a stop to it. Still a crime scene, he would have none of it. Many a curious Masonite would have to wait even longer before setting foot in the mysterious home at 101 East Main Street. Further disappointment fell on the crowd showing at the church when they discovered a closed casket, leaving her gruesome injuries concealed. When the whole long proceedings were finally over, John McClung would be found not guilty of the murder of his wife. John was still the richest man in Warren County, with a net worth of more than $100,000, about $3.7 million in today's currency. The stress of the legal process put an added strain on the 74-year-old. His health declining, this free man would move to Cincinnati to live another 3 years with his sister at his side. He died on October 30th, 1904. His remains still lie next to Rebecca's at Rose Hill Cemetery in Mason. And that brings us to a final chapter on this enigmatic and enduring tale, Rose Hill Cemetery. At more than 11,000 registered plots, it's a sprawling, manicured space for honoring Mason's dead over the centuries. A 2006 article of the Dayton Daily News ran a profile on the cemetery's retiring sexton, a man by the name of Carl Munich. He'd been at the job for more than 25 years at the time. The reporter asked a question he'd been asked a million times before. Had he ever seen any ghosts there? Just once, as it turned out. It was an encounter that left him frozen and confused. One day that seemed just as ordinary as all the rest started with Munich in the office, staring at some files on his desk. He soon heard footsteps, the distinct heels of a woman's shoes against the hard floor. He didn't remember leaving the door open, but assumed in a flash that he must have as he raised his head to face the entryway. There before him, standing in front of his desk, was a small woman in Victorian dress. She was as solid and as real as any other person he'd ever encountered. "Do you know where Rebecca McClung is buried?" she asked him, before he even had a chance to greet her. He turned on his swivel chair to a shelf behind him so he could grab the directory of registered plots. And in the couple seconds this took him, as he turned back to face her, she'd vanished into nothingness. The experience shook Munich, and the memory of it stayed with him through his retirement from the job. But nothing could prepare him for the day he took a tour of the Mason Historical Society and spotted an aged photograph hanging on the wall of the woman he encountered that day, Rebecca McClung herself. Now that we have a full grasp of this genuine Ohio folktale, its historical facts, and the fantastic claims attributed to it, let's turn to someone who can offer even more depth to the story. I had the great fortune of connecting with the Mason native who knows the story all too well. Stephen was born and raised on a farm just outside town. As a young adult, he attended Miami University and led ghost tours of the campus during Halloween season. He now lives in the state of Oregon, but recalls his Ohio upbringing with fondness. An Ohio folklore listener, he reached out to request the topic be covered. How lucky we get to learn of such a rich tale that still shapes the town today. Stephen starts by describing the legend as he knew it as a child. Come, hear his story.
And so what do you recall the story being, maybe as a child, how people talked about it or what the rumor was associated?
I remember from a pretty early age, it had to have been 5 or 6, you know, driving by the house is right in the main intersection of town on the corner. It's the oldest building on the original intersection. And I remember always mom saying, look up in the window and see if you can see Rebecca. And I was like, oh, no, we got to look for Rebecca. And that was just my intro to the legend, was you only knew this woman's first name and that she might be peeking out the window. And then as I got older and through school, this is something kids would talk about on the bus, you know, as we went past it, the house, that is. And eventually you figured out, well, she was murdered, you know, by an ash log. And, I mean, that was the colloquial legend that just existed there. But that was it. You knew this woman was murdered and that she supposedly haunted this building. But other than that, I didn't know her last name or her circumstances or even a time period until I started researching it, which I always thought was interesting, that it was the legend wasn't very fleshed out.
So I'm so intrigued by the way you described that, because the issue being that children were taught to look up into the window to see if you could spot Rebecca, because some of the historical newspaper articles that I've been reading through, that was a habit for a lot of kids even before the murder happened, that Rebecca herself was known to stare out the window, a second story window, down on the people on Main Street below.
Oh.
So even when she was alive, this was a tendency. She would have the window open slightly. So it was believed that she was eavesdropping on people walking on the street below.
That's wild.
isn't that weird how that's still a story?
It gave me goosebumps.
Okay.
Well, it's just neat that can exist. Like, that's reality, you know, and then it just existed through the cultural memory of the place. That's wild.
Yeah, it really must have resonance, that sort of feeling of being spied on by this strange, really peculiar. And the couple themselves were really viewed as a kind of pariah and weird. They were recluse. They were recluse, basically. Very rarely came out of the home. And so I think there was this aura of, like, weirdness that added to the fascination a lot of people had, which, And so when the murder happened, go ahead.
Oh, no, I just think it's so, it carried through. It's spooky, almost, you know, that's still the association that exists with that house, you know.
Right. Anyway. And so you had never spotted her yourself, is that right?
No. I did my best. You know, I'd always look at the curtains, and then, you knew which room she was in. I remember going into the building. I mean, it's had a lot of iterations, you know, different businesses. And at one point, I believe it was a lawyer's office or a tax lawyer. And we went in there, and I remember seeing my mom and this lawyer descend into the basement. And it was just, and I was left on the first floor alone. And it was just such a spooky feeling, which is about the only experience I have, like, supernaturally with it, you know.
But, yeah. Yeah, that must have really left a mark on your memory, being in the building that was so well known as being haunted by Rebecca, especially alone as a child.
Oh, yeah, they must not have been too concerned.
Right. So did you know any others in your circles that claim to have had strange experiences there?
Yeah, I had a friend. I wasn't able to get a hold of them for the interview. But they worked at a French restaurant called the Chocolat Morel, probably about 15, 20 years ago. And that was apparently there was this culture of there being Rebecca's ghost in the building. And she would tell these stories around a campfire about inexplicable things happening in the kitchen. I remember one specific one, you know, where a beer bottle fell off a shelf, and then it had already been swept into a pile by the time everyone got there in the morning, you know, even though no one had been there overnight. Things would go missing, you know. Just all the little inexplicable stuff they say when you have, like, a ghost that haunts a restaurant. It doesn't seem too uncommon, but, I mean, it was all connected to Rebecca. And then I was also told, when it was a French restaurant, and this is getting into the urban legend aspect of it, that it was painted red, and the room has always been red because, you know, to hide the blood of the murder, quote unquote. But
okay,
the
rumor she was murdered was painted red. That was the rumor.
Yeah, that was the rumor. But this is apparently an uncomfortable place to be after late at night, you know, cleaning up. Like, it has, I mean, if you've been in there, it's got the typical, like, Victorian 12-foot tall ceilings, you know, for heat. And so it just has this airiness to it that's kind of empty, you know, but at the same time not.
Yeah. And it really stood out, the building did, when it was first built, really considered a mansion of sorts for its time. And, you know, Mason was a very small town for most of its existence, you know, except the past 20 or 30 years, according to census records, it really grew like exponentially in recent years. But I can see why, you know, that the location just really held the imaginations of a lot of the locals for just how big it was, and not to mention the fact of the odd personalities of the people who lived there.
I mean, I've heard that they were reclusive, but the town eccentric, I guess, would be the term. But yeah, it's one of the few remaining buildings of that period, you know, on the strip there. And it's still very prominent. So.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty easy to find accounts of, you know, ghostly activities there, including at the Mason Historical Society. They claim to have collected a number of accounts of those things happening.
Excellent.
Yeah. So it's quite the pretty well-known reputation, more or less. So did you know much about the trial and all those sorts of things, or was it just sort of this fun little story about, you know, there's supposedly a ghost in this building? I don't know if people knew much about the actual crime itself.
A little bit. I mean, if you take the next step into the legend and do at least a little bit of scholarship, which I've done, you figured out, you know, the leading evidence was that he had blood on his clothes. This is in reference to John McClung. And
right.
His claim was that it had come from a cut in his hand in the barn, you know, a day or two earlier. And then also that he claimed if I had killed her, I'd done it in my sleep, you know, which I know they were living on the second floor of the house, and I'm sure there was a secondary staircase to get up to there, but I don't, yeah, it, to me it seems like he just kind of got off scot-free when the evidence was pretty powerful, yeah, it's a, which I guess I thought in some ways might have fueled the legend of Rebecca still lingering, you know, because it from a broad view, it seems a bit like an injustice, you know? I mean, not a bit, but an obvious injustice.
But. Yeah, right. And then that odd non-denial of, well, I'm not saying I didn't do it, but if I did, I don't remember.
I don't remember. Yeah, just knew exactly what to say in this situation. I was having trouble finding the court transcript I'd like to read. But, I mean, from that, I mean, that's what exists, you know, in the legend is that he killed his wife and he got away with it. And then, I mean, like the kind of the injustice of it. I mean, they're even buried next to each other in the town cemetery, which I thought, I don't know, was, yeah, this is all alleged, of course, but that is the next level of the legend. You know, there's like, well, this is actually, this woman was murdered and no one stood to pay for the crime.
But, yeah. Which is classically what we think of with a haunting, that we have a spirit who is has unrest because the outcome was never resolved. I mean, I don't know if that's your theory about, you know, if Rebecca remains, why she remains, or have you given much thought to that?
Yeah, I think I have. You know, it's in the Gothic, you know, kind of late Victorian story that it is. Yeah, it seems that, like, she would linger for the sense that, well, I was murdered in my own bedroom, you know, with a weapon that was in the bedroom on ash log. Who else was in the bedroom? It had to have been, yeah, it's an injustice. And it really fits that Gothic romance type story. And I think about it, like how it survived all these years and as Mason's changed, you know, and I feel like it's really a story at this point tied to the town's old identity, you know, and not everybody in the school knew it. I mean, if you still had some connection to Mason proper, the little town, you knew the story, you know? And I wonder if it survived in that way, because people are, it's changed so quickly that people are really looking for ways to hold on to that old identity of it, you know, when it was at its peak.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think that's one of the things I enjoy so much about folklore is that it helps deepen people's connection to a place. It gives mm-hmm. you a sense of history and wonder at the same time. You know, and so this story is a good example of that. And it becomes part of the identity of a place, too. Mm-hmm. This is sort of where we come from. And the time frame, you're right, is in the Victorian era when there was a lot of spiritualists and kind of views about spirits existing, you know, beyond death. Was pretty commonplace, and you know, it's still something that a lot of us anyway tend to believe.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
I think that, yeah, I agree. It's well, the spirits themselves, you know, harken back to a time that maybe people yearn for. Like there was a I don't know, an old Mason, new Mason schism in the schools. It was kind of waning when I was in there because the old Mason had already been. You know, the farms had all been built over, at least by the time I got to high school. So that former small town culture was really, I mean, it's still there. You know, you can still find it if you walk around Mason and you talk with people. But it's really been, it's kind of on the run. And I think looking for the ghost of that is still searching for that yeah. old place, you know. And that's,
right.
At least that's how I feel, you know, through sepia right. tone.
Yeah. But, you know, for my listeners who haven't been to Mason, at least not, you know, the proper downtown area, how would you describe the feel of it, what it's like to be there?
Well, if you come in a car, you'd just be frustrated by the traffic. So we lived within walking distance, about a mile or a half or so. And so it's always best to walk into it because it's only about maybe a mile long town along the road at the top of this ridge, and there's a creek that runs along the bottom of it. It's really quaint and beautiful, and you can imagine how pretty it would have been when it was all agriculture and forests around it. But it just looks like any, you know, a Victorian street frontage with Italianate buildings. There's your VFW hall, and there's a couple bars, and a really neat, modern, old city hall. And I remember going with my mom to turn in the water bill, you know, and it's just a really quaint little small town. Growing up, we had festivals, they'd close off the ends of the street, and you really got out to know people. And, the Mason Historical Society Museum was always open, and you could go in. And the Grange, you know, was there selling peanut brittle for a fundraiser. It really had a small town feel to it. And you can still catch that now, but it's getting harder to each time I go back. But it's pleasant, you know. Oh, there's a Victorian cemetery on the other side of the creek, you know, that you can walk through to get into town and past John and Rebecca McClung's graves, just feet from the town founder, you know, so it has this very, you know, old America feel, you know.
Yeah, you know, you describe a kind of idyllic childhood memories, warm connection to the community, but there's also these bits of evidence that remind you of the history, some of which is a little on the spookier size.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I like the combination of all those different things. And it is a bit of a shame if you're seeing some of the growing, what do they call it, urban sprawl, maybe from Cincinnati?
Yes.
And I know that those are some forces you can't control.
Yeah, that's something I had to reckon with myself, and eventually had to just go find a place where I could still see some countryside. But it's gone very quickly. I thought at one point it would slow down, but yeah, you still have the legends, and I mean, if you walk there, you can still feel it, you know. And there's still plenty of people in Mason who, you know, you say, "Oh, how was it used to be here?" And they'll look around and shake their head and say, "Well, there used to be more farms." And but it's I don't know, it still has that vibe in the town itself. So it's survived the sprawl.
So yeah.
They talked at one point about widening Main Street as a thoroughfare, which would have taken out so many of the historic buildings. But like, luckily, it's always been thwarted. So
okay,
yeah.
So there are real efforts to insulate, you know, that area downtown and to keep its quaint nature, like feeling.
Yes, at least inadvertently, that's happened. You know, maybe money's gone elsewhere in the county, but it's pretty nice, but I enjoy it. I miss it in a lot of ways.
So if you get the chance this summer, perhaps after a day's worth of spills and thrills at Kings Island, turn west into town to chase a few thrills of a different nature. Consider strolling down Main Street, and who knows, maybe you'll feel drawn toward one particular building, known today as Thai Terrace. This restaurant now occupies the very structure that has held the imagination of locals and visitors alike for centuries. If you're lucky and get seated near a window, you might just catch a glimpse of what it feels like to look out onto the world of Mason from within. While you may only stay an hour or two, consider how it must have felt for Rebecca, whether she confined herself in this space, or whether she felt unable to venture into the wider world, we'll never know. Perhaps she suffered a crippling anxiety that left her paralyzed, a condition which had no treatment in those days. Perhaps she was the victim of an abusive relationship, suffering a partner who dictated her every move. Or perhaps she was simply an introvert, someone who gained refuge in quiet spaces of her own making. Whatever the case, no one deserves the end she received. She was the talk of the town when she was alive, and it seems she's remained so in death. Let's hope her spirit, if it does yet roam the floors of this building, someday finds peace and acceptance of her fate. May we all someday find the peace that lets our soul rest in this world and the next. This concludes today's episode on the unsolved murder of Rebecca McClung. I hope you've enjoyed it. If so, please rate, review, and subscribe to Ohio Folklore on your chosen podcast platform. You can find out more about Ohio Folklore at ohiofolklore.com and on Facebook. And as always, keep wondering.